crap about love, etc. Why do all these cunts talk about love so much, can you tell me that? A good lay isn't enough for them, apparently. They want your soul, too. Now this word, soul, which pops up frequently in Van Norden's soliloquies, used to have a droll effect upon me at first. Whenever I heard the word soul from his lips, I would get hysterical. Somehow it seemed like a false coin, more particularly because it was usually accompanied by a gob of brown juice, which left a trickle down the corner of his mouth. And as I never hesitated to laugh in his face, it happened invariably that when this little word bobbed up, Van Norden would pause just long enough for me to burst into a cackle, and then, as if nothing had happened, he would resume his monologue, repeating the word more and more frequently, and each time with a more caressing emphasis. It was the soul of him that women were trying to possess, that he made clear to me. He has explained it over and over again, but he comes back to it afresh each time, like a paranoiac to his obsession. In a sense, Van Norden is mad, of that I'm convinced. His one fear is to be left alone, and this fear is so deep and so persistent that even when he is on top of a woman, even when he has welded himself to her, he cannot escape the prison which he has created for himself. I try all sorts of things, he explains to me. I even count sometimes, or I begin to think of a problem in philosophy, but it doesn't work. It's like I'm two people, and one of them is watching me all the time. I get so goddamn mad at myself that I could kill myself. And in a way, that's what I do every time I have an orgasm. For 1 second, like, I obliterate myself. There's not even one me then. There's nothing. Not even the cunt. It's like receiving communion. Honest, I mean that. For a few seconds afterward, I have a fine, spiritual glow. And maybe it would continue that way indefinitely. How can you tell? If it weren't for the fact that there's a woman beside you, and then the douchebag and the water running, all those little details that make you desperately self-conscious, desperately lonely. And for that one moment of freedom, you have to listen to all that love crap. Drives me nuts sometimes. I want to kick them out, immediately. I do now and then. But that doesn't keep them away. They like it, in fact. The less you notice them, the more they chase after you. There's something perverse about women. They're all masochists at heart. But what is it you want of a woman, then? I demand. He begins to mold his hands. His lower lip droops. He looks completely frustrated. When eventually he succeeds in stammering out a few broken phrases, it's with the conviction that behind his words lies an overwhelming futility. I want to be able to surrender myself to a woman, he blurts out. I want her to take me out of myself, but to do that, she's got to be better than I am. She's got to have a mind, not just a cunt. She's got to make me believe that I need her, that I can't live without her. Find me a cunt like that, will you? If you could do that, I'd give you my job. I wouldn't care then what happened to me. I wouldn't need a job or friends or books or anything. If she could only make me believe that there was something more important on earth than myself. Jesus, I hate myself. But I hate these bastardly cunts even more, because they're none of them any good. You think I like myself, he continues. That shows how little you know about me. I know I'm a great guy. I wouldn't have these problems if there weren't something to me, but what eats me up is that I can't express myself. People think I'm a cunt chaser. That's how shallow they are. These highbrows who sit on the terrace all day, chewing the psychologic cud. That's not so bad, eh? Psychologic cud. Write it down for me. I'll use it in my column next week. By the way, did you ever read Steckel? Is he any good? It looks like nothing but case histories to me. I wish to Christ I could get up enough nerve to visit an analyst. A good one, I mean. I don't want to see these little shysters with goatees and frock coats like your friend Boris. How do you manage to tolerate those guys? Don't they bore you stiff? You talk to anybody, I notice. You don't give a goddamn. Maybe you're right. I wish I weren't so damn critical, but these dirty little Jews who hang around the dome, Jesus, they give me the creeps. They sound just like textbooks. If I could talk to you every day, maybe I could get things off my chest. You're a good listener. I know you don't give a damn about me, but you're patient, and you don't have any theories to exploit. I suppose you put it all down afterward in that notebook of yours. Listen, I don't mind what you say about me, but don't make me out to be a cunt chaser. It's too simple. Someday I'll write a book about myself, about my thoughts. I don't mean just a piece of introspective analysis. I mean that I'll lay myself down on the operating table and I'll expose my whole guts, every goddamned thing. Has anybody ever done that before? What the hell are you smiling at? Does it sound naive? I'm smiling because whenever we touch on the subject of this book, which he is going to write someday, things assume an incongruous aspect. He has only to say, "My book," and immediately the world shrinks to the private dimensions of Van Norden and Company. The book must be absolutely original, absolutely perfect. That is why, among other things, it is impossible for him to get started on it. As soon as he gets an idea, he begins to question it. He remembers that Dostoevsky used it, or Hamsun, or somebody else. "I'm not saying that I want to be better than them, but I want to be different," he explains. And so, instead of tackling his book, he reads one author after another in order to make absolutely certain that he is not going to tread on their private property. And the more he reads, the more disdainful he becomes. None of them are satisfying. None of them arrive at that degree of perfection which he has imposed on himself. And forgetting completely that he has not written as much as a chapter, he talks about them condescendingly, quite as though there existed a shelf of books bearing his name, books which everyone is familiar with, and the titles of which it is therefore superfluous to mention. Though he has never overtly lied about this fact, nevertheless it is obvious that the people whom he buttonholes in order to air his private philosophy, his criticism, and his grievances, take it for granted that behind his loose remarks there stands a solid body of work. Especially the young and foolish virgins whom he lures to his room on the pretext of reading to them his poems, or on the still better pretext of asking their advice. Without the least feeling of guilt or self-consciousness, he will hand them a piece of soiled paper on which he has scribbled a few lines, the basis of a new poem, as he puts it, and with absolute seriousness demand of them an honest expression of opinion. As they usually have nothing to give by way of comment, wholly bewildered as they are by the utter senselessness of the lines, Van Norden seizes the occasion to expound to them his view of art, a view, needless to say, which is spontaneously created to suit the event. So expert has he become in this role that the transition from Ezra Pound's cantos to the bed is made as simply and naturally as a modulation from one key to another. In fact, if it were not made, there would be a discord, which is what happens now and then when he makes a mistake as regards those nitwits whom he refers to as pushovers. Naturally, constituted as he is, it is with reluctance that he refers to these fatal errors of judgment. But when he does bring himself to confess to an error of this kind, it is with absolute frankness. In fact, he seems to derive a perverse pleasure in dwelling upon his inaptitude. There is one woman, for example, whom he has been trying to make for almost 10 years now, first in America and finally here in Paris. It is the only person of the opposite sex with whom he has a cordial, friendly relationship. They seem not only to like each other, but to understand each other. At first, it seemed to me that if he could really make this creature, his problem might be solved. All the elements for a successful union were there, except the fundamental one. Bessie was almost as unusual in her way as himself. She had as little concern about giving herself to a man as she has about the dessert which follows the meal. Usually she singled out the object of her choice and made the proposition herself. She was not bad-looking, nor could one say that she was good-looking either. She had a fine body, that was the chief thing, and she liked it, as they say. They were so chummy, these two, that sometimes in order to gratify her curiosity, and also in the vain hope of inspiring her by his prowess, Van Norden would arrange to hide her in his closet during one of his seances. After it was over, Bessie would emerge from her hiding place, and they would discuss the matter casually, that is to say, with an almost total indifference to everything except technique. Technique was one of her favorite terms, at least in those discussions which I was privileged to enjoy. "What's wrong with my technique?" he would say, and Bessie would answer, "You're too crude. If you ever expect to make me, you've got to become more subtle." There was such a perfect understanding between them, as I say, that often when I called for Van Norden at 1:30, I would find Bessie sitting on the bed, the covers thrown back, and Van Norden inviting her to stroke his penis. "Just a few silken strokes," he would say, "so as I'll have the courage to get up." Or else he would urge her to blow on it, Or failing that, he would grab hold of himself and shake it like a dinner bell, the two of them laughing fit to die. "I'll never make this bitch," he would say. "She has no respect for me. That's what I get for taking her into my confidence." And then abruptly he might add, "What do you make of that blonde I showed you yesterday?" Talking to Bessie, of course. And Bessie would jeer at him, telling him he had no taste. "Aw, don't give me that line," he would say. And then playfully, perhaps for the thousandth time, because by now it had become a standing joke between them, "Listen, Bessie, what about a quick lay? Just one little lay?" "No." And when this had passed off in the usual manner, he would add in the same tone, "Well, what about him? Why don't you give him a lay?" The whole point about Bessie was that she couldn't, or just wouldn't, regard herself as a lay. She talked about passion, as if it were a brand new word. She was passionate about things, even a little thing like a lay. She had to put her soul into it. "I get passionate, too, sometimes," Van Norden would say. "Oh, you," says Bessie. "You're just a worn-out satyr. You don't know the meaning of passion. When you get an erection, you think you're passionate." "All right, maybe it's not passion, but you can't get passionate without having an erection. That's true, isn't it?" All this about Bessie and the other women whom he drags to his room day in and out occupies my thoughts as we walk to the restaurant. I have adjusted myself so well to his monologues that without interrupting my own reveries, I make whatever comment is required automatically the moment I hear his voice die out. It is a duet, and like most duets, moreover, in that one listens attentively only for the signal which announces the advent of one's own voice. As it is his night off, and as I have promised to keep him company, I have already dulled myself to his queries. I know that before the evening is over, I shall be thoroughly exhausted. If I am lucky, that is, if I can worm a few francs out of him on some pretext or other, I will duck him the moment he goes to the toilet. But he knows my propensity for slipping away, and instead of being insulted, he simply provides against the possibility by guarding his sous. If I ask him for money to buy cigarettes, he insists on going with me to purchase them. He will not be left alone, not for a second. Even when he has succeeded in grabbing off a woman, even then he is terrified to be left alone with her. If it were possible, he would have me sit in the room while he puts on the performance. It would be like asking me to wait while he took a shave. On his night off, Van Norden generally manages to have at least 50 francs in his pocket, a circumstance which does not prevent him from making a touch whenever he encounters a prospect. "Hello," he says, "give me 20 francs. I need it." He has a way of looking panic-stricken at the same time, and if he meets with a rebuff, he becomes insulting. "Well, you can buy a drink at least." And when he gets his drink, he says more graciously, "Listen, give me 5 francs then. Give me 2 francs. At the Coupole, we stumble into a drunk from the newspaper, one of the upstairs guys. There's just been an accident at the office, he informs us. One of the proofreaders fell down the elevator shaft, not expected to live. At first, Van Norden is shocked, deeply shocked. But when he learns that it was Peckover, the Englishman, he looks relieved. "The poor bastard," he says. "He's better off dead than alive. He just got his false teeth the other day, too." The allusion to the false teeth moves the man upstairs to tears. He relates in a slobbery way a little incident connected with the accident. He is upset about it, more upset about this little incident than about the catastrophe itself. It seems that Peckover, when he hit the bottom of the shaft, regained consciousness before anyone could reach him. Despite the fact that his legs were broken and his ribs busted, he had managed to rise to all fours and grope about for his false teeth. In the ambulance, he was crying out in his delirium for the teeth he had lost. The incident was pathetic and ludicrous at the same time. The guy from upstairs hardly knew whether to laugh or to weep as he related it. It was a delicate moment, because with a drunk like that, one false move and he'd crash a bottle over your skull. He had never been particularly friendly with Peckover. As a matter of fact, he had scarcely ever set foot in the proofreading department. There was an invisible wall-like between the guys upstairs and the guys down below. But now, since he had felt the touch of death, he wanted to display his comradeship. He wanted to weep, if possible, to show that he was a regular guy. And Joe and I, who knew Peckover well and who knew also that he wasn't worth a good goddamn, even a few tears, we felt annoyed with this drunken sentimentality. We wanted to tell him so, too, but with a guy like that, you can't afford to be honest. You have to buy a wreath and go to the funeral and pretend that you're miserable. And you have to congratulate him, too, for the delicate obituary he's written. He'll be carrying his delicate little obituary around with him for months, praising the shit out of himself for the way he handled the situation. We felt all that, Joe and I, without saying a word to each other. We just stood there and listened with a murderous, silent contempt. And as soon as we could break away, we did so. We left him there at the bar, blubbering to himself over his Pernod. Once out of his sight, we began to laugh hysterically. The false teeth. No matter what we said about the poor devil, and we said some good things about him too, we always came back to the false teeth. There are people in this world who cut such a grotesque figure that even death renders them ridiculous. And the more horrible the death, the more ridiculous they seem. It's no use trying to invest the end with a little dignity. You have to be a liar and a hypocrite to discover anything tragic in their going. And since we didn't have to put on a false front, we could laugh about the incident to our heart's content. We laughed all night about it, and in between times, we vented our scorn and disgust for the guys upstairs, the fatheads who were trying to persuade themselves, no doubt, that Peckover was a fine fellow and that his death was a catastrophe. All sorts of funny recollections came to our minds, the semicolons that he overlooked and for which they bawled the piss out of him. They made his life miserable with their fucking little semicolons and the fractions which he always got wrong. They were even going to fire him once because he came to work with a boozy breath. They despised him because he always looked so miserable and because he had eczema and dandruff. He was just a nobody, as far as they were concerned. But now that he was dead, they would all chip in lustily and buy him a huge wreath, and they'd put his name in big type in the obituary column. Anything to throw a little reflection on themselves. They'd make him out to be a big shit if they could. But unfortunately, with Peckover, there was little they could invent about him. He was a zero, and even the fact that he was dead wouldn't add a cipher to his name. "There's only one good aspect to it," says Joe. "You may get his job. And if you have any luck, maybe you'll fall down the elevator shaft and break your neck, too. We'll buy you a nice wreath. I promise you that." Toward dawn, we're sitting on the terrace of the dome. We've forgotten about poor Peckover long ago. We've had a little excitement at the Bal Negra, and Joe's mind has slipped back to the eternal preoccupation, cunt. It's at this hour, when his night off is almost concluded, that his restlessness mounts to a fever pitch. He thinks of the women he passed up earlier in the evening, and of the steady ones he might have had for the asking if it weren't that he was fed up with them. He is reminded inevitably of his Georgia cunt. She's been hounding him lately, begging him to take her in, at least until she can find herself a job. "I don't mind giving her feed once in a while," he says, "but I couldn't take her on as a steady thing. She'd ruin it for my other cunts." What gripes him most about her is that she doesn't put on any flesh. "It's like taking a skeleton to bed with you," he says. "The other night I took her on, out of pity, and what do you think the crazy bitch has done to herself? She had shaved it clean. Not a speck of hair on it. Did you ever have a woman who shaved her twat? That's repulsive, ain't it? And it's funny, too. Sort of mad-like. It doesn't look like a twat anymore. It's like a dead clam or something." He describes to me how, his curiosity aroused, he got out of bed and searched for his flashlight. "I made her hold it open, and I trained the flashlight on it. You should have seen me. It was comical. I got so worked up about it that I forgot all about her. I never in my life looked at a cunt so seriously. You'd imagine I'd never seen one before. And the more I looked at it, the less interesting it became. It only goes to show you there's nothing to it after all, especially when it's shaved. It's the hair that makes it mysterious. That's why a statue leaves you cold. Only once I saw a real cunt on a statue. That was by Rodin. You ought to see it sometime. She has her legs spread wide apart. I don't think there was any head on it. Just a cunt, you might say. Jesus, it looked ghastly. The thing is this, they all look alike. When you look at them with their clothes on, you imagine all sorts of things. You give them an individuality-like, which they haven't got, of course. There's just a crack there between the legs, and you get all steamed up about it. You don't even look at it half the time. You know it's there, and all you think about is getting your ramrod inside. It's as though your penis did the thinking for you. It's an illusion. You get all burned up about nothing, about a crack with hair on it, or without hair. It's so absolutely meaningless. that it fascinated me to look at it. I must have studied it for 10 minutes or more. When you look at it that way, sort of detached-like, you get funny notions in your head. All that mystery about sex, and then you discover that